These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Modern imaging technologies are giving us a much better picture of just what it is our brains are doing when we're thinking, acting, and growing. So today, we're going to talk about a specific period of brain development, what's happening in our heads during adolescence. We're exploring the teenage brain today with our in-studio guests. Also this hour, we'll find out what our listeners say is the riskiest thing they did when they were teens, and we talk with a man who's known as the Teen Whisperer. All that and a new question answer session with our Dr. KTD. That's what's up on Kids These Days today. Unraveling some of the mysteries of the teenage brain. That's our topic today. We love to know what's going on out there with you and your family, so please tell us. Write us a note to mail@kidsthesedays.org or comment on our website or Facebook page. How are the teenage years and the way the brain develops during that time different from what we might have thought before? And what should we as caregivers know about brain development during this time? Well, we have two guests with me this hour in the studio to talk about that. Across from me is Dr. John Petritis. Dr. John Petritis is a professor and the chair of the psychology department at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He's been a social psychologist at UAA for 20 years and came to Alaska from a research center in Chicago that focused on attempts to improve the health-related behaviors of people, behaviors that start or peak in adolescence, like smoking, substance abuse, and unsafe sex. More recently, he's focused on the potential evolutionary explanations for why adolescent and young males take so much risk, and he's been doing his research in Alaska's outdoors. Although he's in his 50s, he describes himself as an incurable adolescent male. Thanks, Dr. Petritis, for being with us today.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Dr. Lawrence Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg is the Distinguished University Professor and Laura H. Carnell Professor of Psychology at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Steinberg is past president of the Division of Developmental Psychology of the American Psychological Association and a former president of the Society for Research on Adolescence. He's one of the world's leading authorities on psychological development during adolescence, and Dr. Steinberg's research has focused on a range of topics, including adolescent brain development, risk-taking and decision-making, mental health, family relationships, after-school employment, school achievement, and juvenile justice. Dr. Steinberg is the author of more than 300 articles and essays on growth and development during the teenage years, and the author or editor of 13 books, including Adolescence, the leading college textbook on adolescent development, and the title You and Your Adolescent. And Dr. Steinberg joins us on the phone today from California. Thanks to you, Dr. Steinberg, for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think the best place to start here is to talk about this very unique and important part of our brain development that is during adolescence. I've read that some of the most rapid brain development and growth happens during those very first years, from 0 to age 3, but that adolescence is also a time where the brain is really doing a lot. And Dr. Steinberg, maybe you can start there and tell us about the time of adolescence and exactly what it is, you know, what is it that the brain is doing that's different than at different times in our development?
Sure. Well, to put it in context, I think it's now agreed upon that outside of the early period that you mentioned from 0 to 3, adolescence may be the next most important period in brain development, and that is a relatively new discovery. I think it had been long believed that the brain was fully mature by the time people reach puberty or early adolescence, and now we know that that's not true. There are several different kinds of changes that are going on in the brain during the adolescent years. And for the sake of our discussion today, let's think about that as stemming from around age 10 till, let's say, the early 20s.
Okay.
I think the part of brain growth that's received the most attention involves a region of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. That's the upper front of the brain, and it is the chief executive officer of the brain. And it's responsible or very important for complicated thinking, for what psychologists call executive function, so things like planning ahead and logical reasoning, and it's also important for impulse control. Mm-hmm. And we know that there is maturation of that region during the adolescent years that's slow and gradual but very, very profound. And so the prefrontal cortical functioning of a young adult is very different from that of an early adolescent. So that's something that most people, I think, who've followed this story in the popular press are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
There's another aspect of brain development that I think is less well publicized, but perhaps equally important, and especially important for our discussion today. And that has to do with this period of arousal of brain systems that are important for the processing of emotional information and social information and reward and punishment. This occurs during early adolescence. We think it has something to do with the hormonal changes that take place during puberty. And it leads to an increase in sensation-seeking and reward-seeking and novelty-seeking during the early part of the adolescent years. And as we get into this discussion today, we can talk about the implications of those two different kinds of changes going on at the same time.
Right. So you're talking about that, the maturation, as you talked about, of this front portion of the brain and how this is almost happening. It's happening in tandem, right, with these other hormonal and other parts of the brain that are changing. And I think with, you know, we'll get into how it is that we see these behaviors exhibited in teenagers, because I think that once we have the discussion, it does just start to make sense in what we all observe. But Dr. Steinberg, can you also elaborate on when you say maturation of the front part of the brain, the cerebral cortex, like what, you know, without getting too much into the expert science part of it, you know, what does that really mean? I've read about myelin, I've read about synapses. You know, can you explain physically what's happening in that part of our brains as teens?
Sure. So it may be helpful to think of the brain as a kind of an electrical system almost, in which electrical impulses are transmitted from cell to cell. Brain cells are called neurons. And the way the brain works is through this transmission of electrical energy from one neuron to another. The neurons aren't exactly touching. There's a little tiny gap between the tendrils that extend from the cell bodies, and that gap is called a synapse. And so for the electrical impulse to get across the synapse, that requires a change in the chemistry of the brain through the actions of a kind of chemical called a neurotransmitter. Now, the reason that this is important is that when we're born, and during early development, our brain produces many, many, many more synapses than we need, and so we can think of this as kind of a system of roads that is way too complicated for what the brain needs to be able to do. And the process of maturation of the brain actually involves the elimination of unnecessary synapses, and it makes the brain much more efficient. It's like going from a network of small gravel paths to a network of fewer but much larger superhighways. And what happens in the prefrontal cortex during adolescence is that an awful lot of synaptic pruning is taking place beginning in the late years of childhood and continuing until the middle of adolescence, and that helps the prefrontal cortex to function more efficiently. Now, at the same time that that's going on, there's also another change that's called myelination. Myelin is a white fatty substance that serves as a kind of insulation, insulation of these networks of neurons that are connected to each other, not unlike the kind of plastic insulation that is around speaker wire, if you have a stereo hooked up in your house where the speakers are wired to a receiver or an amplifier or your home theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the production of myelin around these neural pathways also makes them much, much more efficient, the same way that the insulation around your speaker wire makes that the transmission of impulses along that wire much more efficient. And adolescence and early adulthood is a time of a great deal of myelination in the prefrontal cortex as well. So those two processes, the elimination of unnecessary synapses, which is called synaptic pruning, and the myelination of more neural pathways. Both account for the improved performance of prefrontal cortical functions.
Now, tell us a little bit about the technology as well, because, you know, how is it that researchers are able to see this, to know that these processes are taking place since they're inside our brains, and obviously we're not able to see that with our naked eyes?
Right. So there are a number of different ways that scientists look inside the brain. Perhaps one of the most commons is by the examination of cadavers, of individuals who've died. And that allows you to really look, you know, firsthand at what the brain looks like and how it's changed anatomically at different age periods. This is also done in animal research. As many of your listeners probably know, we share an awful lot in common with other species. And all mammals go through a period that is similar to our adolescent period, so we can compare animals' brains when they're in this juvenile period with their brains before and after, and tell something from that. But I think that the technology that you're probably thinking of is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. That's a technology that's not so important for seeing the structure of the brain, but instead for seeing the brain in action. And in fMRI, an individual is placed inside a scanner, and the scanning technology allows us to see what parts of the brain are active during different tasks. So we could compare brain activity when you were reading a passage on a computer screen inside the scanner versus when you're listening to the same words being read to you through headphones. And that helps us understand what parts of the brain are active when we're reading and what parts are active when we're listening. And we can do this with any kinds of behaviors that we can have people do when they're inside the scanner.
And could you give an example of some of the ways with this fMRI technology, some of the ways that when you examine a teenage brain performing certain functions, that it might look different on those scans than an adult, a fully adult brain doing those same things?
Sure. So let's return to something I mentioned earlier, which has to do with this arousal of the reward system in the brain that occurs early in adolescence. So if we do an experiment in which we have people in the scanner and we show them pictures of things that are rewarding, let's say smiling faces, for example, what you see is that the regions of the brain that are active when we're experiencing reward light up. They're much more active in an adolescent brain than they are in the brain of a child or an adult, even when all three age groups are seeing the very same stimulus. Hmm. And this has been shown in a series of experiments that have used different kinds of rewarding stimuli. And so there is this increase in reward sensitivity that we can see in the brain by looking at the parts of the brain that are known to be active when we experience reward or pleasure.
Hmm, how interesting. So a teenager would just be more receptive or just more sensitive to the idea or the anticipation of reward than someone younger or older. That's what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. And you make an important point in your question, because it looks like that the differences between teenagers and children or adults are much more in the period of anticipation of a reward rather than in the actual receipt of a reward. So teenagers, when told that they might get a reward, let's say we have them in a kind of a gambling task. When we in our lab, we have a task where we call it it's like a wheel of fortune, where it spins around, and if it ends up with an arrow pointing on a zone that indicates you've won, you get tokens, and if it points on a zone indicating you've lost, you lose tokens. So you get the picture of this. And so if we have a child or an adolescent, a child, adolescent, an adult in the scanner, we spin the wheel around that they're looking at on the computer, and we can see how they are responding inside the brain to this image and to the expectation that if the wheel lands on an arrow, they're going to be rewarded for it. And adolescents' brains in the reward centers are much more active during that phase than is the case for children or adults.
How interesting. I'd like to remind listeners that this is Kids These Days, and I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today I'm talking with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg and also Dr. John Petritis, and we're talking about the adolescent brain and how it develops. And as Dr. Steinberg, you mentioned, we're moving into more of a conversation about the arousal parts of the teenage brain, different than specifically what's happening in regions of the brain and the processes of the physical development. We anticipated that we'd be talking a little bit about risk and risk-taking. So before we get into that, I'd like to share this. We here at Kids These Days love to have the occasion to get out and to ask you, the listeners, about one of our topics. And so we did that for the show today. We asked, what is the riskiest thing you did as a teen? Something that now, as an adult, you would never do. And here's what you said in this newest installment of our When I Was Young feature.
I would say go joyriding with vehicles that weren't ours with some bad group of friends, and we just go and pick a car out, take it, drive all night long, then drop it off somewhere else. That was pretty stupid.
My friends and I used to go downtown, sneak out of the house, and just randomly get rides from people that we didn't know, just strangers, because it was exciting meeting new people, driving around town. And I just can't believe I did that, and I can't believe nothing terrible happened to me.
Wow. Did your parents know?
No. I've never told my mom. I don't know how she'd feel if I told her now. I don't think I want her to know that I used to sneak out of the house.
Once my best friend and I stayed at my house. I grew up in a small town. We stayed at my house, and I lived in town, and he lived out of town 8 miles or so. And we snuck out of my house in downtown and walked all the way to his house, way out of town, so that we could steal his mom's car and go meet up with his girlfriend and another friend of hers and do nothing for 5 or 6 hours during the wee hours of the morning, and then return the car back without anybody knowing, and then walked back to my house before breakfast, before anybody got up. I don't think I'd ever steal a car again. Not that we did anything that we shouldn't be doing other than just like hanging out. It was pretty silly. We had to put the car, we had to sneak inside his house, get the keys, go out, put the car into neutral, and push it out of the garage and down the park and down the driveway to the road before we could start it, so that we didn't wake up his parents. And then we had to do the same thing when we got back. Stop, turn off the car, put it in neutral, and push it back into the garage, and return the keys, and lock the door on our way out, and walk 8 miles back into town. Yeah, I don't think I'd ever do that again.
Probably run around with suspect women when there was a lot of alcohol involved. There's some questionable scenarios that came up.
How old were you when you were doing that? Still a teenager?
Yeah, I was pretty young. 16, 17, 18, something like that. Skirting the law, that's for sure.
So when you were a teenager, what do you think the riskiest thing is that you did that you wouldn't do now that you're 25?
Probably took the, when we took the old beat up pickup off-roading, and caught it on fire, couldn't get the fire out. Found a beer bottle to put the fire out with, and then towed it back home, replaced the part before my parents got home.
So nobody knew?
No.
Wow. That's pretty awesome.
Not really.
Going out with friends that have been drinking and driving and booze cruising.
23.
Okay. So according to brain research, your brain is still forming until you're 25. So you're almost there.
Almost.
So what do you think is the riskiest thing you did as a teenager that you wouldn't do now?
I would say go down to Tijuana without with being underage and partying down there.
Did you get in trouble?
A lot.
Those were Alaskan voices from both Kodiak and Anchorage. We arranged them in order of age, starting with the oldest, who is almost 50, and ending with that last gentleman, who is 23. Again, this is Kids These Days, and today we're talking about adolescent brain development with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg and Dr. John Petritis. And, you know, Dr. John Petritis, I'd like to invite you into the conversation as well. We just heard mostly men talking about some of their riskiest experiences that they wouldn't repeat as adults. And, you know, there are some repetitive themes in there. A lot of it had to do with cars and doing kind of crazy and nutty stuff with cars. You specifically look at young males and adolescent males, and you also are really interested in your research with risk and risk-taking, the motivations behind that. You know, what might your responses be to some of these things we just heard?
The reoccurrence of cars, I wouldn't have expected that, especially from Alaskans. I would have expected things involving snow machines, skis, rock climbing, backcountry kinds of things.
Well, let me interrupt. I can tell you I did question a few of these gentlemen a little more and asked about those things. The guy who said he took the car for 8 miles, you know, walked 8 miles and then took the car. I said, well, what about some of the crazy things you've done on snowboards? And he said, well, those are risks that I would probably still take. So if that colors that any for you.
Well, there's a phenomenon known to psychologists and probably known to parents, too, as the young male syndrome. And there is an abundance of really foolish things that are done in the world, and a disproportionate number of them are done by males and done by young males. And so in my youth, I did all kinds of stupid things, and the list could go on and on. And I'm sure the people you interviewed there, they didn't just do one dumb thing.
Right. They just chose to tell me that particular one dumb thing.
And so I've been interested in trying to understand what's the motivation behind young males in particular taking so many risks. And sadly, the risks, I mean, some of the risks end up being funny stories you can tell when you're older, but some of the risks end up with pretty tragic consequences. And it's hard to even pick up a paper any day in Alaska without hearing about another male, primarily a young male, who's died or been seriously injured doing something risky outside. Just this past week, there was in Anchorage a well-known case of an avalanche that happened, and it happened outside of Seattle, but one of the people caught in the avalanche was young and female from Girdwood. She survived, but there were some ski companions of hers who didn't survive, and they were the two who died, maybe three, were both males. So I've been trying to understand what's the motivation behind young males taking so much risk, and it dawned on me that it could be part of the motivation is not just issues involved with brain development, although that certainly plays a role in it, but I think there might be some evolutionary explanations in that maybe young males are engaged in risky behaviors because they're doing those behaviors in an attempt to make themselves attractive as potential mates. And my thinking on this is that female fertility, females are fertile for fewer days per year and fewer years across their life compared to males who, once they reach puberty, are fertile every day and fertile for many years longer. And this creates an imbalance where there are many more fertile males in the world than there are fertile females. And that puts young males at a disadvantage because older males can still be fertile, but they have something that makes them attractive to as potential partners. So,
in addition to their physical selves, right?
In addition to their physical selves, so financially. So I'm financially better off now in my 50s than I was in my 30s and better off then than I was in my 20s. Young males don't have that financial attractiveness to them, but they do have something that old guys like me don't have. They have knees and backs and legs that can recover from things. And so young males might be engaged in risk-taking behavior as a way of advertising their potential fitness as mates and competing with older males in a domain that older males can't compete well in. And so I've been doing research in Alaska's outdoors and watching naturally occurring risk-taking behavior. And in Alaska's outdoors, it's almost always males out taking risks. It's almost always young males out taking risk. And I've been watching to see what happens.
And you recently conducted a study at Alyeska, yes. which is a ski resort mm-hmm. in Girdwood, which is a few miles away mm-hmm. from Anchorage. And, you know, what can you reveal some of those findings that you've found?
Yeah, I'll start out by saying they did not turn out exactly as I expected, but mm-hmm. I suspect when Dr. Steinberg hears this, he'll go, yep, I would have predicted that. So I was observing covertly skiers and snowboarders in the terrain park at Alyeska. And so the terrain park has jumps and it has obstacles that people slide along or jump over. And I was covertly off to the side monitoring what was going on and keeping track of whether the skiers or boarders were males or females and roughly how old I thought they appeared to be, whether or not there were other observers around, other skiers and snowboarders, and keeping track of what they were doing when they're going through the terrain park. So were they doing front flips? Were they doing back flips? Were they rotating side to side 360 degrees or 180 degrees? Were they going off jumps backward? Were they going off jumps and grabbing their skis or boards and trying to measure the amount of risk they were taking? So a flip is, you know, more risky than
yeah,
exactly
than
and so I quantified how much risk they were taking, how fast they were going over these jumps, and I was expecting to find that the skiers and snowboarders would engage in riskier behaviors when there were people of the opposite sex observing. And what I found was, well, first off, it was almost impossible to find a female in the terrain park engaging in any risk-taking behavior. Hmm. Females tended to, if they were in the terrain park, they tended to be observers. They would ski in with a group of friends, watch what was going on, and then ski through without going off any of the jumps. And I found it was, I think, 94% of the people in the terrain park who did anything other than just ride through were males, and almost all young males. And then I looked to see, well, do these young males engage in more risk when there is a female observing? I thought that's what I'd found, and I actually found that if anything, males tended to engage in a bit more risk when there were other males watching. So I was a little bit surprised by that finding, but the overall finding that this is a young male environment and they engage in risk around other people is very consistent with Dr. Steinberg's research and a lot of other research.
Well, I'd like to get Dr. Steinberg's reaction to that, but first we need to take a quick break. This is Kids These Days. It's a production of the Content Producers Guild, an independent Alaska media organization. We're recorded and distributed through partnerships with KSKA-FM Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Still to come this hour, there's more conversation with Dr. John Petritis of the University of Alaska Anchorage and Temple University's Dr. Lauren Steinberg. We'll hear advice for caregivers from a man who's known as the Teen Whisperer, and Dr. KTD weighs in as well on the way it is that some teens smell. All that still to come on Kids These Days today. Stay with us and we'll be back in a minute.
Sound of silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager. Then you think again. Sound of silver, talk to me, makes you want to feel like a teenager until you remember the feelings of a real live emotional teenager.
Are you doing something special for your dad this Father's Day? We are. Listen to Kids These Days next time when we take a look at fatherhood in this country and how the role has changed and stayed the same over time. Learn about the Alaska Native fatherhood movement in our state and discover the power of male mentors. That and more. Join the conversation.
Thank you.
We're back. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this hour, Dr. Lawrence Steinberg of Temple University and UAA's Dr. John Petritis join me for a discussion about the teenage brain. And before the break, Dr. Petritis was telling us about a recent study he did about risk-taking, particularly with adolescent males, and he did the study at a ski resort here in Alaska in Girdwood. And Dr. Steinberg, I was wondering, you know, Dr. Petritis' results were somewhat different than he anticipated, and I'm wondering what your reaction to that might be.
Well, I think that Dr. Petritis is probably thinking about some work that we've done in our lab at Temple where we have adolescents play risk-taking games on the computer with or without their friends watching them. One of the games that we use is a driving game where you approach a series of intersections, the light turns yellow, and you have to decide whether you're going to run through the intersection or not. You have the chance of finishing the task sooner if you make it through safely, and you get more points if you do that, but you also have the chance of running into a car that's crossing through the intersection, in which case you crash and you lose time and lose points. And we have done this with adolescents and adults, and we've done it both just in regular test rooms, but also inside the fMRI scanner. And what we have found is, just as Dr. Petritis observed in his study, that in the presence of their peers, adolescents take many more risks than they do when they're doing the exact same task by themselves. And I think any parent who's listening to this broadcast probably has wondered at one time or another why their teenager will do such stupid things when he or she is with friends that the teenager would never do if alone.
Right.
And we have a partial answer to that, I think, from our scanning research. It appears that when teenagers are being observed by their peers, the reward centers of their brain are more active than they are when they're doing the same thing and they're by themselves. What we think happens is that because of this activation of the reward centers in the presence of peers, teenagers pay more attention to the potential gains of a risky decision and less attention to the potential costs, and therefore they're more likely to take the risk. We're working more on this, but that's our hunch so far. We have done this experiment with both boys and girls. We find the same effect, but our experiments so far have always used peers of the same sex, and so we don't have data yet on how adolescent boys would respond on this task if they were being watched by female adolescents. Mm-hmm. There is at least one study of actual driving in the real world that shows that adolescent boys drive in a much more reckless way when there are other boys in the car, but they drive in a safer way when there are adolescent girls in the car.
How
so I'm not surprised at this observation. I do have one little factoid that I think Dr. Petritis would be interested in hearing, and I agree with his interpretation of this completely. I've been digging around looking at age curves to see when different kinds of risky behaviors peak. And most of them tend to cluster around 16, 17, 18 years old. And it turns out that that is also around the age of peak of fertility in human females. So if you asked, well, what's the age at which you would maximize the number of children you would produce over your lifetime, that's the age when you should start. If you start a lot younger than that, a lot of infants born to very young adolescents don't survive. If you start later than that, you'll have less opportunity to have many, many children. So evolutionarily, it makes sense that if the reason for the risk-taking behavior is, as Dr. Petritis suggested, to make the male more attractive to females, the age at which you want to do that is the age at which the females are going to be most fertile. And the two time periods are really, identical.
Interesting.
And it seems interesting to me, and it fits with this evolutionary explanation.
So interesting. And let's continue talking about the teenage brain as it fits into our ideas about evolutionary theory. Because as you mentioned, Dr. Steinberg, you know, sometimes parents think to themselves, I don't understand how my kid can be acting this, you know, stupid, for lack of a better word. But there's this thing that I encounter called the adaptive adolescent story, that is really that, you know, you could look at adolescence and this changes in the, these changes in the brains in such a way to say, well, teenagers just kind of, you know, are acting ridiculous for this period of time. You just have to get them through it. And it's just this period of time where they don't make any sense. Or you can look at it differently, where you can say that this exquisitely sensitive and highly adaptable creature is really wired for this transition of going from their parents' home into a world where they make it on their own and with this new cohort of people that they'll go through their life with, and those are their peers. And that this highly, you know, you've used the word of like these highly sensitive times and highly sensitive period parts of the brain. And I'd like you to comment on this idea, the adaptive theory, and whether or not that's something that you're subscribing to as well.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes in the sense that there may be behaviors that that adolescents engage in that have survived through the process of evolution and natural selection and are still retained in the species today. So they're adaptive in that sense, that they have survived because they improved chances of reproducing. But they aren't necessarily adaptive in today's environment, because the context in which these behaviors are displayed is very different than it was when we evolved. So I do think that, and I also want to say that it's possible to get a little carried away with the evolutionary explanation, and it kind of becomes a just-so story. I think clearly a lot of the behavior of teenagers is under their volitional control. They're not simply passive recipients of biological influence. So I don't think that we should start to see adolescent behavior as completely determined by their biology. But I think we should recognize that there is a biology that's specific to adolescence, and it does influence our behavior. And actually, you know, a lot of the risk-taking behavior that we see in human adolescence is seen in adolescence of other mammals as well. And so even juvenile mice are more likely to take risks than adult mice are. And that's true for, you know, juvenile primates, you know, non-human primates as well as humans. So this does seem to be something about adolescence that has been conserved across many, many different species.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's notable that the period of adolescence is a period that is different than other times, not just in Western culture, but observed in other cultures in the world as well. And that's true, right?
Oh, absolutely. There isn't a culture, you know, in recorded history that doesn't recognize that there is a difference between this group of individuals that are no longer children but not yet adults and people of other ages. Some recognize this with a formal ceremony, a rite of passage. Others recognize it by having laws that govern things that young people can do and things that they can't do but that we permit adults to do. But every society recognizes adolescence as a special period of development.
And Dr. Steinberg, when you were talking about that, responding to the adaptive adolescent story, you mentioned that, you know, the risks or the, or I'm sorry, this is the evolutionary backing to adolescent behavior. You said that, you know, risks traditionally, or, you know, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, are different than the modern day risks. I'd like to invite Dr. Patitis to talk about that, because you have another study that you've recently been working on where you are looking at attractiveness, like whether or not someone would find another person attractive if they take a traditional risk, like, you know, fighting an enemy versus if they take a modern risk, like opening that attachment from that person who sent the email that you don't know. Could you comment on that study and some of the things that you found?
Yeah. So I was interested in one study looking at, do males and females find risk-taking behavior in partners attractive or unattractive? And I developed a questionnaire that asked people about the attractiveness of different types of risk. And one broad category of risk is what I call hunter-gatherer risks. And it's the kind of risks that you would face if you were currently on a camping trip that lasted your entire life. So you'd have risks involving crossing water, you'd have risks involving temperature extremes, risks involving what types of foods that you could eat out in the wild, risks involving gravity. And so I have this broad category of hunter-gatherer risks. Also, there are risks that we can take today that have no parallels at all to the kinds of risks that ancestral humans have faced for hundreds of thousands of years. So opening an email attachment, plagiarizing a paper in college. And so I put together a questionnaire asking people about these various risk-taking behaviors, in which one of them, these risk behaviors, if any, would make someone more attractive as a dating partner and which would make them less attractive as a dating partner. And what I found in the questionnaire is any modern risk, opening an email attachment from a stranger, pirating a DVD, anything involving electricity, those kinds of risks were essentially turn-offs both for males and females. But the hunter-gatherer risks, like rock climbing, whitewater kayaking, eating spicy peppers, those kinds of risks did not make females more attractive, but did make males more attractive. And so males regularly engage in risk-taking behavior more so than females, and it could be because females say we actually like it when males take risks. So some of the stupid things I've done is get into pepper eating contests and seeing how many habanero peppers you can swallow. And males,
and then the next contest is how many Tums you can eat.
Yeah, and males will do that, and females will often shake their heads and go, I would never do that. But there might be some benefit to males to be able to show that they can do that.
Hmm. Well, let's take it back to the teenage brain. This is Kids These Days, and we're talking about the teenage brain. And I'm joined by Dr. John Petritis, who's from UAA, and Dr. Lawrence Steinberg is on the phone with us from California, and he's a professor at Temple University in Pennsylvania. And let's together listen to this. There are a lot of changes during adolescence. The brain is evolving, puberty has taken hold, and something else that's shifting is whose opinions kids care about. Sorry, Mom and Dad, you're no longer the number one voice of reason. But while a teen's peers are ever more important, there are ways for adults to continue connecting. 30-year-old Josh Shipp is a teen behavior expert, an author, and a TV show host whose work is all about getting through to teens. He's been called Dr. Phil for Teens and the Teen Whisperer, and he shared some of his getting through strategies with our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, on a recent one-day visit to Anchorage.
Hi, Josh. Thank you so much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
What do you do and why do you do it?
So for the past 12 years, I've been working with young people as a speaker and author, a behavioral change expert. And for me, it started in the way that I grew up. I grew up in the foster care system, sort of had this unideal childhood growing up, a lot of difficult things that I went through, and then through a series of getting involved in my school, having a big brother through Big Brothers Big Sisters, finding a great set of foster parents, I began to, with their help, turn my life around. And then I knew that I wanted to take some of those lessons and difficult things that I've learned and experiences I've had and help other young people.
It sounds like you had a number of caring adults in your young life, and now that's something that you're returning the favor in a way through the work that you do.
Yeah, so I did have a number of caring adults. And I think if I had to just give one piece of advice to any young person listening, I think that's the best thing that any young person could do to change their life, to better their life, to better some area of their life, is to find someone older and smarter than them, hang out with them, say, how can I improve my life, and then actually do what they say. And as parents, this is a great resource as well to help and encourage your kid get a mentor, because when a kid becomes an adolescent, regardless of how wonderful of a parent you are, you're no longer their number one source of influence. It's typically their friends. And so a mentor can be someone who's sort of preaching your same message, but it's a different messenger. And so you're much more likely to help influence them. You know, the right mentor in a young person's life can and will accelerate their success. And the research shows that teens that have mentors are close to 50% less likely to engage in negative behavior, drugs, alcohol, these sorts of things, because they have someone that they respect as a older peer that would call them on it and that is encouraging them to a better way of life.
Do you hear teenagers coming to you feeling frustrated and overwhelmed?
Yes, I think one of the challenges that young people have today is that in the culture that we live in, they have the genuine stresses of a 30-year-old, but they have the experience of a 15-year-old, both neurologically and that the research shows that their brain doesn't yet comprehend, not doesn't want to, but truly does not comprehend long-term consequences, and they're 15 years old. So a lot of these situations they're running into socially and in school and the pressure and becoming independent in college or career, they haven't had the experience, so it's very overwhelming. And so that's why consistency as a parent and support and encouraging as a parent is very important. That's why, furthermore, having that mentor in place is even so much more crucial. That's so important because I think everything that's great starts with a phase of overwhelm.
So just get beyond it.
Yeah, get beyond it. That's the mindset, but now what are the tools? The tools are, if you're a young person, don't be afraid to ask for help. You don't have to show your insecurity to everybody, but those handful of people you really trust, don't hide the fact that you're freaked out. Don't hide the fact that you don't know what the baby steps are. Don't hide the fact that you're not sure what the next step is. Ask someone that you know cares about you and allow them to help you. Now, if you're a parent, you don't want to do it for them. This is very important. You're like a coach, right? The coach does not step on the court. The coach prepares the athlete prior to the game and encourages from the sideline, but they do not step on the court. The same thing is true for you as a parent. The kid needs to feel that overwhelm. You need to ask yourself, have you prepared them to successfully fail, deal with hardships, deal with overwhelm? Because that is such an important part of young adulthood.
Josh, in your work, you have a TV show and you have an internet advice show and a website, and kids write into you and they ask you questions and they ask for your advice. And you have said that there are things that parents don't know or don't understand about teens, and that's sort of where one of the roles that you can play. You bridge that gap. What are some of the things that you think parents don't understand?
It's a good question. Here's what I think it is I think that parents aren't sure how to communicate and engage with their teenager. Because like I said, the moment they turn 14, you could be the world's most amazing parent. But in that time that you're establishing your independence, they're no longer the number one source of influence. So I feel like parents feel very frustrated by that situation, and that I'm not sure, you know, what's happened to my baby, and how do I get through to them, and how do I get them to understand. And there are ways that you can do it. That is the good news, is that, guess what? Your kid is listening to you, even if they don't have the maturity to say thank you. You are making a difference, even if they don't have the maturity to tell you that you are. So I think little things that you can do as a parent are, number one, speak their language. And what platforms do they feel comfortable communicating and expressing themselves? And you go and engage them on those platforms. So for example, a really practical, free, easy thing you could do, your kid has a test today. Send them a text message. Hey, I'm thinking about you. Good luck. That is you communicating in a modality that they feel confident and comfortable in, and expressing your encouragement and care for them. And it's, you know, it's amazing. So many young people are more comfortable expressing themselves through that modality of technology because that's sort of what they've grown up with. So we could complain about it and say, oh, my kid's texting all the time, or you could use it as a vehicle, as a tool for you as a parent to influence your kid. Another practical, easy thing you could do, find out what your kid's favorite movie is and watch it with them. Don't judge it. Watch it with them and then have a discussion about it. Now, oftentimes these movies are movies you wouldn't want to see. They're violent. There's language. Don't focus on that. Focus on what is behind the movie that the kid is drawn to. right? It's not the language, it's not the violence. Is it, you know, someone who was counted out, who then ended up being a hero and successful? When you will submit yourself into their territory, then you're able to have these sorts of conversations with your kid, because you're coming into an area where they're confident. You'll have amazing conversations with your kids. Those are practical, easy things any parent could do.
Those are great ideas. Josh Shipp, thank you so much for speaking with Kids These Days.
That was motivational speaker, author, and TV host Josh Shipp with a message aimed at teens and the adults who love them. He spoke with KTD producer Sarah Gonzalez. We'll connect you to his website from ours. That's kidsthesedays.org. This is Kids These Days, and I'm Shanna Sheehy. And today I'm speaking with Dr. John Petritis from UAA and from Dr. Lawrence Steinberg from Temple University. And Dr. Steinberg, I'd like to invite you to respond to some of what we just heard Josh Shipp say. I imagine in your position of knowing so much about the teenage brain and how it's developing, that you might also find yourself in a position of people asking you for advice sometimes on what to do with this teen in their lives.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's all the time. You know, as you mentioned at the start of the show, I have a book out for parents and for other adults who come into contact with, maybe work with teenagers, that goes through the basics of adolescent development and discusses adolescent brain development as well. I think it is extremely important that adolescents have at least one adult in their life who is committed to them. And, you know, we know that having a close relationship with an adult and having an adult who's present in your life is one of the strongest deterrents against risky and reckless and criminal behavior during adolescence. And that emerges as, you know, a factor in research on this over and over and over again. For most teenagers, it's one of their parents, but it doesn't have to be a parent, and it can be a mentor, it can be a teacher, it can be a coach or something. But the more likely adolescents are to have close relationships with adults who can not only serve as role models, but also monitor and guide their behavior, the less risky behavior they're going to engage in.
I imagine that if a caregiver has a better understanding of what's physically and chemically happening in the brain, based on a lot of this interesting stuff that you can read about with what's been found about brain research in the teen, it just seems like it might give caregivers a different place to observe the behavior of their teens from. You know, like you said, it's not necessarily a pass on bad behavior or an assumption that teens are just passive recipients of what's happening in their brains, but it does seem like a caregiver could be more informed about why their child or the person that they love who's a teenager can be one way one day and then completely different the next, and yet still be that same child that they've known. That's just a comment, I guess, that I thought was interesting based on the conversation that we've had today.
Well, you know, I think that when you're a parent, the more you understand about the normal development of a child who's the age that your child is going through, the better parent you can be, because you can understand why a child behaves the way he does, and you can respond in a way that's consistent with this understanding rather than react in a way that might be based on erroneous information or stereotypes or misguided emotions.
Right, the emotions of the moment. Dr. Petritis, I'd like to invite you maybe to give the last word here in the time that we have today. You're an Alaskan, and do you have any particular advice for caregivers of Alaskan teens? Like you said, we have, you know, risks that are available to kids here that have to do with the snow and out of doors that are different than in some other places, or maybe more accessible than in some other places. And then, of course, in Alaska, we also have some competing factors of, say, light and dark. Mm-hmm. Issues that might also feed into some of the brain chemistry that's happening with teens. I'd like to give you the last opportunity.
I would tell parents that adolescent risk is normal, and don't try to stop it. Maybe channel it in directions that are less harmful. So encourage outdoor winter activities. Make sure they have a helmet. Make sure they have avalanche beacons. You know, make sure that they do it wisely. Teach them how to do it. I would also say teach kids about risk And one of the things I used to say to my son when he was 14, he's 18 now, I would say, what has less common sense than a 14-year-old boy? Two 14-year-old boys. And so I
didn't like hearing that.
Well, and then I changed it to 15-year-old and 16-year-old. But there was always some wisdom in that, because whenever he did anything that was less than brilliant, he never did it by himself. He was always around others. And so I've raised my kids to, you know, enjoy the outdoors of Alaska and take the risks, but train them to take the risks wisely.
Well, that is all the time we have today. I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Dr. Lawrence Steinberg is the Distinguished University Professor and Laura H. Carnell Professor of Psychology at Temple University. And Dr. John Petritis is a professor and the chair of the Psychology Department at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Thank you both for your time and your expertise this hour. It's been great.
It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
You can find out more about both of today's guests by going to our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. You can also listen to this program again or share it with the people that you think who might want to hear it. Our archives include a series of shows about the behavioral and emotional development of adolescent boys and girls, if you would like to hear more. And a quick search from our homepage will take you to those if you're interested. Every so often on Kids These Days, we hear from our Dr. KTD. Dr. KTD is Anchorage pediatrician Michelle Laufer, and today she's filling us in on another pressing question about teenage development. Just why does your teen smell like that?
Something we hear about from parents frequently with teenagers is the body odor and the onset of body odor and how we can handle that. What it is that we all have two kinds of sweat glands. The kind of sweat glands that put out the watery, salty substance that, you know, children through obviously late adulthood, you know, have that sort of sweat. They're called eccrine sweat glands or eccrine. And they cool the body, and they can lead to body odor, obviously. And what happens is as the sweat is on the body, the bacteria on your skin start to metabolize things in that sweat, and it's sort of the products of those that smell. And then as a teen, you start to have the other kind of sweat gland come into play, the apocrine sweat glands, and they put out sort of a milkier, different kind of sweat. And these are primarily located in the armpits, around the genitals. And when bacteria interact with that kind of sweat, it gives that very distinct odor. And that is most active in those teen years as you're going through puberty. So that's why teens often have a very distinct smell. Ways that teens and families can handle a teenager's odor. One is to drink plenty of water and lots of leafy green vegetables and fewer, you know, less caffeine, fewer garlic, and fewer super spicy foods. They can also obviously shower daily and make sure you have soap as an option for them. Remember to change your underwear every day and keep your private areas clean. Obviously, antiperspirant and deodorant. Antiperspirant that cuts down on the sweat and deodorant that just sort of cover up smell. But it's sort of remarkable how many teens don't know the basics of that. They really don't know why you use antiperspirant or deodorant. And they really don't understand that it is important to wash those areas of your body. So I always go back to basics.
Anchorage pediatrician Dr. Michelle Laufer is Dr. KTD. That's it for Kids These Days today. As always, thanks for spending the hour with us. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor, and Sarah Gonzalez is our producer. You're invited to give us your feedback, concerns, questions, comments, recommendations, ideas for programs, comment on our website, or do so by way of our Facebook page, or send emails to mail@kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and we'll see you next week.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidsthesedays.org.